So it is the night of a full moon, so let's imagine. Nottingham Buddhist Centre, February 2013, a full moon puja. A young woman, what was her name? Jane, maybe, has been coming along for a few months. She feels drawn to the Dharma but is cautious. Tonight, she plans to make her first offering in the puja. She feels excited. She feels nervous. She has to light from another tea light on the shrine. Might her light put out the light from someone else's offering? Might she be clumsy, bowing before the shrine? She chooses to walk up with someone who looks particularly kind. Jane walks with careful steps. She chants. She focuses her eyes on the rupa. She gets closer. She lights her light. It shines. She places it before the Buddha. She drops to her knees, folds her hands. She bows. She bows. She bows. She stands. She walks back with lighter steps. She returns to her place among others. She feels different, a bit shaky, moved, as if something has shifted in her being. The full moon shines over the Buddhist Centre, over the city of Nottingham. Let's imagine. Still February 2013, Bodh Gaya, the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, a full moon puja. It is the International Order Convention. There are 500 order members, over a quarter of the worldwide order. It is a unique spiritual gathering for Bodh Gaya, women and men, Indians and Westerners, maybe an Indian woman leading the ritual. It is the place of the Buddha's enlightenment. The atmosphere here is always electric. Dharmacharis and Dharmacharinis walk with careful steps, barefoot on warm paving stones. They circumambulate the Mahabodhi temple. They chant. They come to the Bodhi tree. They share a puja beneath its ancient branches and heart-shaped leaves. They offer lights. Something is shifting, resonating even deeper in that atmosphere. The full moon shines over the temple, over Bodh Gaya. So the title of this talk is Ritual, a Path to Truth and Transcendence. And the subtitle is From Nottingham Buddhist Centre to Bodh Gaya. So ritual is deeply embedded within our humanity. It's part of our history going back to ancient times. In a way, it's an acting out of our humanity on levels which are deep and even sacred. And traditionally, ritual engaged with the profound, significant events of our lives. It was collective. It was held by the tribe, by the community. And it was often about rites of passage, coming of age, entry into manhood, departures, death. It was about a deep connection with nature, respectful and reverent, about the elements, earth, water, fire, air, about sun and moon, light and dark, the changing seasons, about storm, or about a calm, fragile beauty. It was about other creatures, other beings, a relationship with the gods, a longing for the transcendental. Karen Armstrong, writing in A Short History of Myth, is describing myth, but ritual is its expression, and she writes, "It is not about opting out of this world, but about enabling us to live more intensely within it. It gives us new insight into the deeper meaning of life. And then the question is, does this work for us? Contemporary Western civilization is at a distance from all of this. We are the first human beings to live mainly without ritual and without that level of being. Our lives, 21st century lives, are largely based on the rational and the materialistic, denying the intuitive and the mythic. And our inheritance is the enlightenment of the 18th century and not the enlightenment of Bodh Gaya. And for these reasons, it can be hard for us now to open up to ritual. We can be sceptical. And there'll always be, for particular individuals, I think, difficulties around association with a religious upbringing, Christianity, other religions, something we may wish to leave behind. And also temperamentally, ritual may not seem to work for some of us. That's very understandable. But we can also explore it, stay open, maybe just come along. Come along, show up. What is there for us? So we may well have lost our cultural roots in ritual, but we do have a strong sense of the arts. We have highly developed, highly refined cultural traditions, a flowering of human consciousness. And Bhante Sangharakshita, our founder, emphasizes the importance of the aesthetic, the importance of the arts. And for us, there can be a doorway into spiritual experience. And I think the arts have a natural affinity with ritual, and ritual itself can be a work of art, but we're part of it, we're within it, we're living it. But we also need to bring a discriminating mind to ritual. Not all ritual is great, and ritual can be very unskillful. At its extremes, we could think of the Nazi rally, the matador in the bull ring, an assertion of the self and the group, often flamboyant dressing up, colour, music, ritual movement, the smell of blood. The terrible delusion of glorifying your own life by destroying the lives of others. Foolishly trying to assert that your life is permanent, separate and satisfactory. And actually, it's just heartbreaking that people can do this. So ritual needs an ethical base and thus a true beauty. Very interestingly, on a spiritual level, ritual is not about an assertion of the self, the flamboyance of the self, and it's not about the group. So how does ritual work? Well, for me, in my early days of practice as a Buddhist, I think I had a mixed response. I was open to the puja, but I wasn't that strongly affected by it. And then I went on a retreat at Taraloka in 1987, which was about Buddhist images and symbols. And this was just an awakening for me. It connected with a whole deeper vision within me. So I really remember that time. And it took me back also to my own childhood. I had an isolated childhood in the countryside. It took me back to my play. And also, for particular reasons, I studied history of art from the age of six. I read a lot. I had a strong visual imagination. I acted out my stories. So as a child, I was running around the garden, waving a sword, my plait streaming out behind me. And I lived in so many worlds. And I knew that life was deeply significant and visionary. And so what followed from this, the best I could do, I studied English literature, I taught it, and I directed plays. So I took myself into the aesthetic, but also the collective and the shared. And on that 1987 retreat, I discovered that all of this was fulfilled in the Dharma, and I asked to become a Mitra. And now, of course, as an order member, I lead ritual, and I just kind of love creating it and shaping it, and the sense of theatre, the vision, and shared with others, and with a very deep purpose. So quite briefly, I'd like to look at devotion and ritual in the Buddhist tradition. So we could go back to the time of the Buddha, after his enlightenment experience at Bodh Gaya. And it was all very simple. There wasn't developed ritual. The Buddha was alive. There was a sheer radiance of his enlightened presence. The atmosphere was always electric. People met him and the impact was huge. Probably shock waves throughout their being. Sometimes they became enlightened on the spot. So they gave utterance. They spoke words of wonder. It was so clear. What else would you do with your life but follow the Buddha? How else would you wish to live? And they probably experienced the wish to worship, salute, confess, rejoice, ask for teachings, help others to find this path. So it was just like the puja was happening on the spot, then and there. So approximately 500 years on, we have the Mahayana tradition, the Great Way. The Buddha has died. The teaching has become formalized. It's lost much of its vitality. Society has moved on and changed. But the reverberation of the Buddha's enlightenment is still very alive. And from those conditions, a new vision has to arise. It's urgent, compelling, you can't hold it back. A new shaping of the deep truths of the Dharma. And so, to summarize the Mahayana quite simply, what arises is an awareness of the transcendental presence of the Buddha. The Buddha always there, transcending time and space. And corresponding with that, the emergence of other transcendental figures, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And there's the emphasis on the doctrine of shunyata, form and emptiness, as we recite it in the Heart Sutra. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form, the truth of how things are. And most primarily, compassion. Our practice is not just for ourselves, but for the benefit of all beings. And ideally, compassion is the motivation of our lives, how we think and feel and act. And with all of that, of course, there arose new forms of meditation, devotion, and ritual. And ritual then continues to develop within the Buddhist traditions, for example, in the Tibetan tradition and the Zen tradition. So how do we now bring ourselves in contact with this vision? Well, we need faith. All of this is true and possible for us. And we need another human faculty to draw on, something more than our ordinary sense experience. Something more than our rational thought, important as these are. But we need imagination. We need that primary human faculty. And of course we have Bhante's teaching, particularly in the paper Reimagining the Buddha. So imagination is part of us. It's part of our humanity. It's our potential. And I haven't got the time to say a lot about the imagination here, but just to set the context, we could say that imagination enables us to see more deeply, see beyond. It is the faculty of insight and the visionary faculty. So it is the insight that sees the truth of things, impermanence, insubstantiality. And it is the vision that opens up to the transcendental. And we do have at least some glimpses of this in our lives. All of us, I think, have this in some degree. So it's a faculty within all of us. We still need to check it out, check it by our immediate experience, check it with our rational thinking. And then we need to nurture and cultivate our imagination. And we can do that in various ways, through meditation, through visualization, and through ritual. So many, many hundreds of years later, we have the Triratna community, a new Buddhist movement, Western and worldwide in the 20th and the 21st century, holding the deep truths of the Buddha's teaching and knowing the need again to recreate the fine balance of tradition and creativity. And that could also be true of ritual. could we be reimagining ritual? How does ritual manifest in the throbbing heart of a big city? Or how does it manifest in Nottingham on a Wednesday evening? So we need ritual to be part of the energy, the wellspring, the heartbeat of our spiritual lives. So let's look at ritual in the Tree Ratna community. So I don't think ritual is a path on its own. It's part of our system of practice, integration, positive emotion, receptivity, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And I don't have time to elaborate on this either, but ritual contains all those aspects. And Bhante has created particular rituals for us. The dedication ceremony, the threefold puja, the sevenfold puja. And I met with him a few months ago and asked him about this, and he said many things, but he talked about writing the dedication ceremony and just composing it the night before the dedication of a particular new community. And then it has stayed with us as our practice over the years. And with the sevenfold puja, he was drawing on tradition. The puja is traditional in Eastern religion, but he was also recreating it. So our puja is not the monks chanting and the laity listening, fine though that might be, but it's call and response. It's led and it's all our voices. And we also have ritual ceremonies, which are our spiritual rites of passage. Mitra ceremony, Kalyana Mitra ceremony, private ordination, public ordination, marking the key events, the moments of significant change in our spiritual lives. And we have ritual for particular occasions, departures, a mitra convener or a chair leaving a centre, for funerals. And these may have no fixed form, they're created specially for that occasion, for that person. And we have rituals to honour what are our significant days in the passing of the year. Parinirvana Day, Buddha Day, Dharma Day, Padmasambhava Day, Sangha Day. So our rituals can be beautiful, precise, they can be a bit rough and ready. On retreat we create our own rituals inside or outside. I think living at Tara Loka, my sense is of us increasingly creating rituals in the landscape, which actually make the landscape just feel and be more mythic. So the rituals have an effect, there's a continuity there. Now a particular ritual may not suit everyone, but we gather, we practice together in this way. We let go of personal preference as part of something larger. And Bhante writes in his key book on ritual, Ritual and Devotion, he says, just enjoy it. And he encourages us to practice puja regularly. He emphasizes the value of doing it again and again. He says to honor it. He suggests we dress smartly for the puja. And the puja, our ritual practice, well, we're creating positive mental states, maybe with our own distinct texture. How do you feel when ritual is going well? They have their own emotional quality. And maybe we can feel moved, tender, compassionate, joyful. We can feel shame. We can feel gratitude. We can feel longing, aspiration. And there's a texture to those feelings. And more than that, it's about atmosphere, a sense of presence, what we're creating, what may have been created in that space before. So we're becoming more receptive to the transcendental. We're able to invoke the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And maybe something happens. And with all of this, the consequences will be positive. So there's also the mystery of the effect. And for me, well, particular rituals have been some of the high points in my life. Mitra ceremony, Kalyana Mitra ceremony, private ordination, public ordination. And I've experienced them all myself, and I've now conducted most of them. And I think leading, it's a privilege, and it's also humbling. It's about service. It's about having to step up. and you're in a very special space in relation to others. It can be mysterious, a bit wonderful. And also, all of those times we're also human, we're flawed human beings. And I sometimes think in ourselves, we're not big enough. I'm not big enough. But this is also about going beyond self, about meeting others within the context of something greater, maybe shimmering, resonant, palpable. And I can do it because I'm part of the order and am held by the order, and I'm part of something greater than me. So I'll just share three of my high points, particular rituals. So a tea ceremony at Tara Loka on the lower clearing on the summer's evening. So Sobhanar was there, very active. And over 20 women sat for over an hour together to experience receiving and drinking a cup of tea, and also to see each other receive and drink a cup of tea. And I think, well, we thought something stirred in the surrounding atmosphere. It felt special in the clearing, in the woodland. You could hear the sound of a twig breaking. You could hear the call of a bird. And there was also a kind of reverent silence. There was a sense of presence, as if something more was going on. And we returned to the shrine room and just sat together and didn't want to leave. Or another more personal, unforgettable ritual was taking my mum's funeral. She'd asked for a Buddhist funeral. And before the committal, I walked over. I stood beside her coffin. I stood beside her. And I chanted the traditional blessings in Pali for her, for my mum. And 9 months later, January 2007, on pilgrimage in India, I and 31 others, on the full moon night at Bodh Gaya, walked across the dried up riverbed, circumambulated the Mahabodhi temple, and took our place beneath the Bodhi tree. So these are very magical, special moments. So we can say of ritual that it's about transformation, it's about the collective, about the imagination, and about invoking the transcendental. And ritual can be like living in a work of art, as if drawing us up to the Rupa Loka, the realm of aesthetic form. And ritual is a total experience, it's an experience of body, speech, and mind. It's all of us, and on deeper levels. So I'd like to look more at the detail, the different aspects. So starting realistically, we're human, we're flawed, we can be tired, distracted, uninspired, and we've probably all experienced this. But also we've shown up, and things can shift for us, and we take our place existentially as living, suffering human beings and as members of the Sangha. And our presence matters. Each of us there, it matters. And we are in a sacred space, as we are here, as we are upstairs, the shrine, the rupa, the flowers, the light of the candles. And the space and these things hold a different energy beyond the mundane. Objects can seem less fixed. They are less substantial. She, Karen Armstrong, writes more about this, but also within the Zen tradition. They put it well. They say that things are themselves, but they're more than that. They also symbolize their essential nature. So a flower symbolizes what a flower really is. A candle symbolizes what a candle really is. The moon shines in its moon nature. And then there's language. Sound, the words of poetry, more evocative, symbolic language, wonderful language. On the paving, sprinkled with perfume, I scatter handfuls of beautiful flowers. May they remain here for endless ages so that life in this world does not grow dark. And we have mantras, chanting. And Bante writes in Ritual and Devotion that mantra is more subtle experience. And he says, the mantra is a sound symbol. A mantra is essentially an inner sound, an inner vibration, even an inner feeling. And it can hold the quality, the texture of the particular Buddha or Bodhisattva that it invokes. And I think something in our being resonates with all of this because it is the truth. And then there's also physical movement. In ritual, our bodies can be more gracious. We fold our hands, we bow, we might prostrate. The flow of energy within us is more subtle. Our emotions can become more positive and refined. Our boundaries soften, are more permeable. We're a bit more insubstantial. We can experience ourselves differently. We're more beautiful. We shine more. And ritual is generally experienced with others. We can have meaningful personal ritual, but ritual is primarily collective. So we can go beyond preferences. We just do it together. It's the shared experience, and this can take us beyond ourselves. And with ritual, I think there are three ways that ritual can potentially take us beyond the self. And this is that we're practicing with others, we're practicing for the benefit of others, and we're opening up to the transcendental. We're practicing with others, we're practicing for the benefit of others, and we're opening up to the transcendental. And so we become more mythic. And Bante writes, puja is the act of the spiritual community. And very strikingly, he says, we symbolize the Sangha jewel. We symbolize the Arya Sangha, so the transcendental Sangha. So that's quite hard to take in. But it suggests that we are more than ourselves. And we could say that we symbolize our true nature or get closer to that. I think just very occasionally, I can have a sense that I've done this before, a different epoch, a different building. I made offerings with others, but who knows? And another feeling, well, I wish to do this kind of practice as fully as I can with my spiritual friends and within the order to be part of a momentum whereby we might be reborn together or at least keep meeting together again and again. And I wouldn't want this to be happening and not to be there with those friends, not to have done enough. And Bante presents an even larger vision of the puja. He says, it is a timeless process which is going on throughout the universe, practiced by countless beings. So that's very visionary. A timeless process which is going on throughout the universe, practiced by countless beings. So this evening, we'll share a sevenfold puja at Nottingham Buddhist Centre. In the puja, we're human, we're flawed, we might be a bit tired, distracted, uninspired, but also we've shown up and our presence matters. And the puja, for many of you, not for all of us, is familiar, but also we could see every puja as a spiritual adventure, a fresh beginning, a journey into the known and the unknown. It is a reminder and a discovery. And the puja, maybe this puja, can have a deep effect we might not even know at the time. Or it might well be the gradual path, puja by puja, then something happens. So the sevenfold puja, it's based on the Mahayana text, the Bodhicaryavatara by Shantideva. It's the expression of an enlightened mind. And it's compiled for us by Bante, our teacher, so there's his mind there as well. It's a series of devotional moods, a spiritual journey, and just quite simply, I'm going to evoke the stages for you. So having met this path, we wish to worship, to show gratitude, to make offerings. We want to give so much. We can't really offer Mandara River flowers, and nor could Shantideva, but it's if we could, because we can in our imagination. And then it goes deeper. Salutation. Continuous respect, wonder, again and again, the three jewels coming fully into focus. And then we commit ourselves. We voice our going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then we feel all our imperfections, our unworthiness, and we confess. And then we feel released, purified, so we can rejoice in the goodness of others and that we have this path. The three jewels are here in our world, in our lives. And then we ask, we entreat, because we and others need the teaching so that life in this world does not grow dark. We wish for insight. So we hear a reading and we listen. We really listen because it's words of wisdom. And then we recite the Heart Sutra. We recite it together, our collective voices speaking the truth, the words of insight. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. And we get a glimpse, if only we could really understand, but we let the words echo in our space. And maybe we have some sense of luminous space. And then, in a way, we turn back. We transfer our merits to all beings and we surrender ourselves. We turn back to the world. We wish to alleviate the suffering of all beings. So the climax of the puja is compassion. And then we often have a second mantra if we need a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva with us at this moment. And finally, we chant the concluding mantras, invoke the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to be there in that atmosphere and in our welcoming hearts. And then we sit together in peace, shanti, 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 fading into silence. So now, here, we can come back from that particular journey of the imagination. But also we can look ahead. So let's imagine. February 2018, Bodh Gaya, a full moon puja, the next international order convention. Maybe 700 order members, over a quarter of the worldwide order. They circumambulate the Mahabodhi temple. They chant. They come to the Bodhi tree. They share a puja beneath its ancient branches and heart-shaped leaves. They offer lights. Outside the temple, in the streets of Bodh Gaya, the moon shines on the beggars, the deformed, the tiny children, waiting, waiting. Before the Bodhi tree, something is shifting, resonating even deeper in that atmosphere, as if something is happening. Nottingham Buddhist Centre, still February 2018, a full moon puja. A beautiful shrine, the Rupa sitting in sacred space. Jane had left for a while, but is now a Mitra who has asked for ordination. She kneels confidently in the front row. In the distance, a siren wails from a police car or from an ambulance. The moon shines on a woman standing on a dark street, waiting, waiting. Inside, voices coming together, chanting a mantra. The Sangha has gathered, large numbers, for the benefit of all beings. A sense of presence, atmosphere, resonance, as if something is happening. So ritual, a path to truth and transcendence from Bodh Gaya to Nottingham Buddhist Centre.